Hi, this is Marlene with Miami Ghost Chronicles, and I want to welcome you to another episode of Stories of the Supernatural. Wherever you find us, whether it's a video or podcast on your favorite platform, please like and subscribe to us so that you can get notification of when a new show is released. You can also find us on major social media platforms. If you go to MiamiGhostChronicles.com, you can find links to the videos or MP3 files, which you can download and enjoy without commercial interruptions. If you're into classic horror, ghost, and adventure stories, I narrate Nightshade Diary, and you can find links at nightshadediary.com. If scary stories are your bag, and listening to encounters with cryptids, ghosts, dogmen, and other weird creatures sends a shiver up your spine, then go to supernaturalstorytime.com for links to our weekly podcasts. Noteworthy news about the paranormal world, true crime, conspiracy stories, and anything that is just plain weird can be found at eerie.news or visit the Stranger Than Fiction Stories tab at MiamiGhostChronicles.com. Please subscribe to my newsletter on Substack. Just go to mppelliser.com for a link. I want to thank you for being part of my audience, and I think you are all wonderful. Hi, everybody. This is Marlene with Stories of the Supernatural. And this week's episode, this is not with a guest. It's just a few interesting stories that intertwine one with the other, and it's titled Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings, A Murder Mystery and a Ghost. Now, first of all, Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings was a very famous writer that published several stories. One of the best known was The Yearling, which won a Pulitzer Prize in 1939. However, let's go back to the beginning. She was born in 1896 in Washington, D.C. In 1919, she married Charles Rawlings, and in 1928, with an inheritance from her mother, they bought a 72-acre grove near a hamlet named Cross Creek for its location between Lockloosa Lake and Orange Lake. It cost them $14,000. 52 acres were planted with orange trees and 20 were planted with pecans. Charles Rawlings had two brothers who owned a gas station in Island Grove, which was close by. Now, when the Rawlings moved to Cross Creek, it was a poor rural lakeside community. Its residents survived by fishing, hunting, planting kitchen gardens, and tending orange groves. When they bought the house, it had seen better times. The original home was built around 1880, and eventually two tenant houses were moved and attached to its side. Historic preservation experts believe the house was originally built as a two-room cabin with a dog trot or a breezeway running through the house from front to back. Additional bedrooms were built in the 1890s, while a dining room and kitchen were added in the 1920s. This practice of using a breezeway was very common in Florida architecture prior, of course, to the introduction of the air conditioning. There was no electricity or an indoor bathroom. The house was not electrified until Rawlings had been living in the house for 10 years. And even then, the source of power was a Delco generator installed in a nearby pump house. Renovations on the house did not start until 1930. Marjorie would only get used to having a faucet in the kitchen and an outdoor shower and an outhouse. The first year the couple came to Cross Creek, Charles Rawlings went off to Tarpon Springs and spent 6 months on a sponge boat writing a story for Collier's Magazine. They separated in 1928. However, it wasn't until 1931 when Rawlings, who had been working on the house and as far as renovations were concerned, got an indoor bathroom paid for by the proceeds of her 1931 story titled Jacob's Ladder. Her bathroom had the first indoor plumbing in Cross Creek, and she held a party to celebrate it. Her neighbors were what were referred to as Florida crackers. Their residents soon warmed to her, and she used many of the landscape and the people she met. She wrote short stories about the poor backcountry Florida residents. Reception to her stories was mixed, since some of them didn't realize she was describing them, and one mother recognized her son and threatened to whip Rawlings until she was dead. Ironically, Rawlings was known to curse as good as the men and drank and smoked in an era when this was considered unladylike. She once shot 32 rattlesnakes in the woods near Arcadia. In between her riding, she rode horseback through her farm and worked the orange groves. She went hunting through the land with a hound close by.
She wrote her first novel, South Moon Under, in 1933, set at Cross Creek, which tells the story of Lant, a young man who supports himself and his mother by selling moonshine. She lived with a moonshiner for several weeks in order to prepare for writing the book. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. These were the years of Prohibition, and Rawlings got her moonshine from stills in the Ocala National Forest. 5-gallon jugs installed in the house's attic sluiced booze to her bar in the parlor. She stayed living at Cross Creek during the Depression, writing on a screened-in front porch on a Remington or Royal typewriter. She hired neighbors to wash, cook, and clean while she wrote. The original typewriter was stolen after her death, but the table, which is a circle of cypress atop a cabbage palm trunk, is the original one she used. Her husband had originally made it to play poker on, but she took it over after 2 weeks when he finished it. Next to the typewriter is an ashtray. She was a heavy smoker and would smoke up to 3 packs of Lucky Strike cigarettes per day. Next to her typewriter, she had a narrow daybed where she would nap on the porch. She dedicated herself to write 8 to 12 hours per day. In 1938, The Yearling was published, and it won the 1939 Pulitzer Prize. It would go on to be translated into 16 foreign languages. That same year, she sold the rights to MGM for $30,000. That was also the same year that her marriage ended, since Charles did not appreciate rural living quite as much as she did. The publication of The Yearling is what propelled her to fame, and MGM released a film based on her novel in 1946. Gregory Peck, Claude Jarman, and Jane Wyman starred, and the film won 2 Oscars for art direction and cinematography. It was nominated for 5 other Academy Awards. Fame, though, drove her inside her bedroom when too many curious people showed up at her front door. Between 1912 to 1949, Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings published 33 short stories, most of them set in North and Central Florida. Rawlings then went on to marry Norton Baskin in 1941, and they bought a cottage in St. Augustine. He was a hotelier who bought an old mansion, which he remodeled and ran as the Castle Warden Hotel. Present day, it is the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum. The couple lived mainly at Crescent Beach, but then Rawlings bought a house in New York, and she would split her time between both properties. He would stay behind to run the hotel. By the time she bought the house in Van Hornsville, New York, her infatuation with Florida had grown stale. Her last book, The Sojourner, was not set in Florida and received mixed reviews. The end of Rawlings' love affair with Cross Creek started when her neighbor, Zelma Kaysen, sued her for invasion of privacy in 1943. Kaysen was the one who had helped her soothe over the problem with the mother of the son depicted in Jacob's Ladder, who wanted to thrash her to death. Rawlings had helped Zelma Kaysen take the 1930 census. The pair rode horses into the remote areas of Alachua County, which was mostly inaccessible by automobile. Many of them were turpentine caps. 12 years later, the good friends had become enemies. Rawlings thought she had a good friendship with Kaysen and immediately went to speak to her. This, however, did not stop Kaysen from going forward with a lawsuit for libel and asking for $100,000, but it was changed to invasion of privacy. The passage that Zelma Kaysen sued her over described the character in the book that was supposedly based on her as, quote, an ageless spinster resembling an angry and efficient canary, and then further on, I cannot decide whether she should have been a man or a mother, end quote. Kaysen was represented by Miss Kate Walton of Palatka, one of the first women admitted to the Florida bar. And it came out, though, that Kaysen was indeed a very profane person, which one of the neighbors testified could be heard for 1/4 mile swearing. Surprisingly, despite her use of profane language, she was referred to by the local newspapers as one of Island Grove's society ladies. It took 3 years before the case went to trial. When Marjorie arrived at the courthouse with her husband, she was overheard to say, "Now I know how Antoinette felt in the tumbrel." Phillips May and Sigsby Scruggs represented Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings. Scruggs had represented many residents of Cross Creek, some on charges of hog stealing, moonshining, alligator poaching, and even incest. He was hired just to pick the jury for the defense. Rawlings testified for 2 days, and the jury found for her in less than 30 minutes. A total of 51 persons testified to to the accuracy of the description in her book. For Rawlings, what was at stake, besides avoiding to pay damages, was the belief that a writer should have the freedom to describe accurately the world around them as they saw it. Kaysen appealed and the state Supreme Court reversed the decision. Ultimately, Rawlings was ordered to pay damages in the amount of $1 and $1,050 in court costs. The case had dragged through the court for over 5 years. The battle cost Rawlings $32,000 in legal fees. It also took on toll in both her time and emotion, and she felt betrayed by Zelma Kaysen. She never wrote another book about Florida, even though she'd been considering writing a sequel to Cross Creek. In February 1952, she suffered a heart attack when she was alone in Cross Creek. Then upon her death in 1953 from a cerebral hemorrhage, she donated her property to the University of Florida, Gainesville, where she taught creative writing. By then, the property included 125 acres. In 1971, the state took over the Cross Creek property and declared the home a historic site. Much of the furniture in her home are replicas. However, the Singer sewing machine, her bureau, the couches are her original possessions. Her husband, Norton, died in 1997, and they are buried side by side at Antioch Cemetery near Island Grove, Florida. Towards the end of his life, he admitted he had made a mistake in burying Marjorie in Antioch Cemetery when she had asked to be interred in the Citra Cemetery. The story he told was that Tom Glisson was buried in Citra. He had been their neighbor and friend and also a character in the book Cross Creek. When they attended his funeral in 1950, Marjorie told him this was where she preferred to be buried. However, when she died, he believed the cemetery was closer to the Cross Creek property. He didn't realize the mistake until they arrived at Antioch Cemetery to bury his wife, and by then it was too late. Zelma Kaysen, who never married, died in 1963 and was buried 20 feet away from Rawlings in Antioch Cemetery. Ironically, her tomb is inscribed with, quote, immortalized in the writings of Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings. Now, the following is a story that was unfolding while Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings was living at Cross Creek, rubbing elbows with the Florida Crackers and the Moonshiners and producing beautiful literature. It took place in a small town called Rockledge, Florida, and it's southeast of Alachua County in central Florida. Now, this story starts out as a murder mystery and eventually became a ghost story that persists until today. It's November of 1934, and Ethel Allen, age 18, has disappeared. A ring of turkey buzzards soaring overhead and lighting the ground attracts the attention of three truck drivers coming through Florida from Alabama. They were the ones that found her nude, mutilated body on the shores of the Indian River north of Ugale near Rocky Water Tourist Camp. The decomposed body was identified by Alma Finney, who owned the house in Cocoa where Ethel boarded. The Finneys owned a rooming house above the Walters Billiards Parlor. Identification was made by a tattoo mark on the victim's right thigh, above her knee, which displayed a rope circle around the initials B.K. Mrs. Finney also confirmed a gold ring set with a ruby belonging to the girl. The body demonstrated marks of extreme brutality. Her throat had been cut, and she had a knife wound on her forehead and at the base of the skull. The right side of the face had been crushed, and the upper teeth and part of the jawbone were missing. One leg was almost gone, and the murderer had tried to dispose of the body by burning it and then throwing it in the river. Only a patch of hair remained on the back of the head. She was nude except for a piece of stocking around the ankle of 1 foot. Her clothing was never found, only her purse with $26 inside of it. The last time Ethel Allen was seen, she was getting into a car with a man known as William H. Wilson. She was also seen drinking with him, and witnesses said he was taking her to visit her relatives in Wachula. It seemed that Wilson disappeared from Rockledge right after Ethel's murder. By November of 1934, the police received a tip that Wilson was seen on Flagler Street in Miami, driving a new Ford two-door sedan with a Pennsylvania license plate. Patrols were sent throughout Miami's downtown area and even into Miami Beach without any success. No doubt the authorities in Rockledge wanted to ask him a few questions about him and Ethel. But it turned out that Wilson was one of many aliases used by Willard Borton. In 1935, he was finally indicted in the murder of Ethel Allen. By then, it had been determined they were constantly in each other's company before Ethel's body was discovered. At that time, he was known around town as Jersey Devil Borton. The years rolled forward, and the Allen family suffered the loss of another daughter named Edith, who married when she was 15 years old and died in March of 1938, age 16, just 1 month after having a baby girl. By then, Borton had fled the East Coast. However, the law caught up to him in California in 1939. He'd become a jewel thief, known as the Phantom of Bel Air. He had stolen about $1 million in jewels from the homes of Hollywood movie stars such as Gary Cooper and Barbara Stanwyck among them. He was also wanted for various robberies in New Jersey, and he had broken out of prison in that state. Upon his arrest in California, the case was refuted in Florida in order to determine if there was sufficient evidence for an extradition warrant to prosecute him for Ethel's murder. Sheriff Roy F. Roberts, who investigated Ethel's murder, a tavern proprietor, two former waitresses in a restaurant where Wilson was accustomed to eat, a minister who had seen the man about Rockledge, where he occupied a small cottage, and three acquaintances of Ethel were questioned during a review of the case. Purposely, the name of these persons was omitted from the article with the exception of the sheriff. Now, obviously, at first blush, you would think that the names were omitted purposely because these people didn't want to be tied up to such an ugly crime. But later on, you might think that there might have been other reasons why they would not want to testify in a trial against Borton or as to who or what happened to Ethel. Now, in California, Borton had also started using an alias, and that was Ralph Graham. However, per the FBI, his fingerprints matched up with Borton's as well as his picture. He had even married a woman named Charlotte using the alias of Ralph Evans. He pled not guilty and not guilty by reason of insanity for the charges of stealing approximately $2 million worth of jewels. In May of 1939, Borton was sentenced to life imprisonment as a habitual criminal after pleading guilty to robbing the home of Carol Lombard and two other persons. Apparently, it was determined there was not enough evidence to bring him back to Florida to face murder charges. Now, this is the same year that Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings won the Pulitzer Prize for The Yearling. Now, let's fast forward a couple of years. It's 1942, and Barton was serving his sentence in Folsom, and he escaped with two other prisoners but was recaptured. He tried again in 1947, but that plan was foiled by deputies. Now, Ethel might not have gotten justice as far as the law was concerned, but it caught up with Borton nonetheless when his throat was slit by another prisoner in Folsom. He was the prisoner's barber, and they had used also a hatchet on him. Fred Evans, the other prisoner who killed him, had been sent to Folsom in 1941 after killing a man named Fred Silvers who lived in a hobo jungle in Santa Cruz. They had argued over Evans' association with the youth. Remember, these are the years right after the Great Depression when there was a lot of what they call these homeless or hobo camps around many of the cities, major cities in these states. So, and sometimes, unfortunately, many horrendous crimes did take place and that were never either investigated or solved. Borton had been killed in October of 1949, and Fred Evans, who at first blush seemed to have been the person that killed him, met his own grisly end 2 months later in December when he was killed by burglar Frank Marcus, who knifed him in the back. Eventually, two other men would be charged with the murder of Willard Borton. John Allen and Lewis Smith got the death sentence for killing Borton. Their sentences were upheld by the Supreme Court. They had also been described as ringleaders in a San Quentin's condemned row mutiny. In April 1951, they got a stay of execution after it was appealed based on the claims that two other prisoners had committed the murder and that their conviction was based on testimony of another prisoner who was known to be mentally ill. It won them a reprieve for 6 years, but in February 1957, they were executed in San Quentin's gas chamber. Now let's go on to the good part, the haunting, the ghost reveal. And it all has to do, of course, with poor Ethel. But let's go back to right before Ethel gets killed. It's the early 1930s. There's a man named Jack C. Allen. He comes down from Pennsylvania. And he opens a gasoline filling station, a small restaurant, and also a small vending machine business that he named Allen Amusements. 1933, Prohibition is repealed, and he decides to build a tavern. As a matter of fact, his first jukebox, he installs it into the restaurant, which he opened on New Year's Eve, 1933. The eatery and bar were designed with a Tudor flair, and cypress lumber from a local mill was used to build it. Allen sold beer, wine, and food, and many claimed he had the best steaks on the coast. The two-story restaurant was located on US 1 close to the FEC railroad tracks. It was so close to the tracks, the building would shake when trains thundered by. Locals and travelers to and from South Florida would frequent it. It must have been during its early days when Ethel Allen was killed. There has never been mentioned if she was related to the owner. It's interesting to note that when she was killed, the tavern had opened, but business was so good that construction was going on to expand the size of the tavern. Despite the advertisement for Jack's Tavern as a place where, quote, friends meet, in 1936, while it was closed for remodeling, someone had broken in, stolen a rifle, a case of liquor, and cigarettes. The outrage of Ethel's murder died away. That was until Borton was arrested in California in 1939. This is the time that supposedly these unnamed persons were brought in to discuss the case as to whether they would extradite Borton back to Florida to face charges. Who they were talking about was Jack Allen and the waitresses and everybody that worked there who apparently had seen something of what was going on with Ethel and Borton right before she disappeared and then turned up dead. Apparently nothing, they never decided to do anything with that. Now, in 1944, 10 years after he opened it, Jack Allen sells the restaurant to a man named Conrad Korecki, who renamed it to Cooney's Tavern. Then, 3 years later, Korecki brings his brother-in-law named John Zelenska down from Cleveland, Ohio, to work for him. 7 weeks after he comes to Florida and starts working there, he drops dead of a heart attack. Then, a few years later, in 1951, Cooney's Tavern is robbed. As a matter of fact, what's called a riot call comes into the police department when two men created a disturbance at the restaurant and fled from officers. What the nature of the disturbance was is unknown. A few months later that same year, a young boy named Isaiah Armstrong, he's 12 years old, he's struck by a car right on Dixie Highway, right by Cooney's Tavern. He suffered head injuries, was hospitalized, but survived, and as a matter of fact, went on to become a reverend. However, this incident could be the inspiration for a story of a child's ghost that was said to haunt the restaurant, this is later on, of course, after being killed by an automobile just outside the premises. Then in 1953, two airmen from Patrick Air Force Base were arrested for robbing cars parked in the restaurant, and in 1957, the restaurant was robbed of cash and liquor. Then in 1968, Korecki died and ownership was taken over by his family. Now, for some reason, this place was a magnet for thieves. In 1960, it was robbed by a bandit who was waiting inside a cottage owned by the family that was right next to the restaurant. This was around 3:30 a.m. The father and son arrive. The son goes to the cottage and he finds a man in there. He brings the son out at gunpoint to where the father is, along with a poor neighbor who was there at the wrong place at the wrong time, holds them all at gunpoint, trying to force Korecki to open the door. He lies to him and tells him he doesn't have the key. Eventually, the criminal forces Korecki's son to drive him to West Cocoa, where he fled on foot. Then in 3 years later, the restaurant was held up right after midnight by three men who subsequently were arrested for the crime. This seemed to have been the straw that broke the camel's back with it, because within a few months, Cooney's Tavern was up for sale. However, there were no takers, and they continued to own it. Then in 1969, another pair of burglars were busted by police trying to pry open a window with a screwdriver. Then in 1970, in other words, this came totally out of left field. In 1970, a mafia associate named Harlan the Colonel Blackburn was on trial in Jacksonville. Blackburn for years had been known as head of the cracker mob that had ties to the Trafficante mafia family. The mob was an assortment of various Anglo criminals who operated gambling, moonshining, and other rackets in the rural communities of Central Florida. The prosecutor was looking for a witness named Clayton Karecki, who happened to be the owner of Cooney's Tavern, as a crucial witness. Blackburn was accused of interstate commerce in illegal gambling operation. Karecki had been subpoenaed twice, and he would send a certificate stating he suffered from a heart condition. The prosecutor seemed to doubt his claim and had FBI agents watch him for 2 weeks, and they observed him working in the restaurant and waiting on customers as usual. When the prosecutor subpoenaed Mrs. Karecki, she also supplied a certificate signed by a Dr. Ross from Merritt Island. When the prosecutor spoke to Dr. Merritt, he said that Karecki had asked him for an excuse because he felt the trip would be too taxing, but that he believed Karecki would be physically able to testify by deposition. The judge ordered that Karecki and his wife Bessie not leave their home until they were examined by a court-appointed cardiologist. The judge wanted to make sure that more than one doctor examined the pair, but after a three-hour examination by Dr. Daniel Jacobs, eight other cardiologists were contacted to schedule the examination for Karecki. However, they all claimed that they were booked a year in advance. Yes, all eight of them. Part of the importance of Karecki's testimony stemmed from information provided by Star prosecution witness Thomas McCormick, who for 4 years had been Blackburn's bookmaking manager and at the same time an undercover informer for the FBI. He testified that Karecki had deeded over his Cocoa Beach property in part payment of a $20,000 gambling debt. Finally, Karecki testified that he had made, quote, an arrangement through the colonel to mortgage his Cocoa home for relief of a $16,000 to $17,000 gambling debt that he owed to Blackburn's bookmaking chief. His wife denied any knowledge of her husband's gambling debts, even though they shared a checking account. However, it became known that while arrangements were being made for the transaction, Mrs. Karecki had sat with Blackburn's girlfriend while they watched the Karecki children. Karecki denied that he traveled to Miami with Blackburn to peddle the mortgage. He said he didn't know what had happened to the mortgage note, even though he had not paid anything for 2 years. It appeared that this was how Blackburn got payment from bookmaking debts owed him. Blackburn was also running illegal Latin American lotteries in Bolita. This was a game imported into Tampa from Cuba during the 1880s. During the 1950s, it was the bread and butter of underground Florida. Blackburn would eventually be convicted of gambling charges and spent the last 25 years of his life behind bars. He died in 1998. But let's go back to the 1970s. It's 1972, and Cooney's Tavern has become known as the Mad Duchess. And ironically, it was opened with a mobster theme. Then in 1975, it was renovated and renamed the Loose Caboose. Now, it seemed that perhaps Ethel's ghost was being blamed for the restaurant's poor performance because in May 1975, Reverend Chip Finzer with a local Episcopalian church performed a seance and exorcism on the premises. Several people attended. They described having cold chills run up and down their spines. Reverend Finzer said he felt there was more than one spirit there. Somewhere along the line, there was a belief that Ethel was killed in or around the tavern, which is why she haunted the place. Reports of Ethel's ghost were described by both employees and patrons. One woman said she had seen an image of another woman besides her reflected in the mirror. She screamed, and when a waitress arrived, she saw the same thing. The owner of the Mad Duchess and a waitress had seen the same image, which could only be viewed in a mirror. A night bartender saw a woman in a white dress walk from one booth to another when the restaurant was closing. He checked to see where she went and found nothing. Willie Schumacher, the owner during the 1970s, said, quote, "It all began the night we opened Halloween of 1974. Things disappeared. You answered the phone, no one at the other end. You were on the balcony, the radio downstairs started blaring. You came downstairs, it stopped." End quote. A bartender who claimed the ghost wouldn't bother him had a bottle fall and explode at his feet minutes after making the statement. The owner recounted that he was told Al Capone and Dutch Schultz came to eat at the restaurant all the time, which would have been difficult to do since Capone in 1934 was serving time in Alcatraz. However, that he was in Florida during Prohibition is assured, since he bought a house in Palm Island on Florida's East Coast in 1928. Supposedly, he planned the St. Valentine's Day Massacre while living there. During the years of World War II, the restaurant was called the Battleground of the Navy, and there were more casualties within its walls than in the war. The hotel that Schumacher owned and tore down was said to have been a house of ill repute. In September 1975, it seemed there were spirits that didn't want to leave. One employee felt a hand on his shoulder, and a cook saw something pass him in the kitchen. It was very early in the morning, and he was waiting for workers to arrive. During the remodeling, a workman found three secret rooms. There were also reports of a child spirit attributed to a little girl, which again, I believe, were in reality basically lost in translation from when Isaiah Armstrong was hit by the vehicle. In 1977, the restaurant was renamed Sparrowhawk. It was bought by Bryn Mawr Camp Resorts, who had bought it from B. Morley and her brother Norm Kolsch, owners of the Mousetrap in Cocoa Beach. Then, in 1979, it was called Gentleman's Jim's. The strange occurrences continued. Reports of flickering lights during the night, alarms going off without a good cause, and dishes falling and breaking. Rockledge psychic Gene Stevens visited the restaurant in October of 1981. Some areas were described as stifling, and the women's restroom made one tingle, and there was something compelling about the mirror where a name crystallized, but they never disclosed what that name was. On a second visit, Jean Stevens said she saw two uniformed men who were dragging another man down the south end stairwell. While he resisted, a young girl pleaded to have the man released. She felt another experience where she saw a knife involved and a woman running down the stairs. There was another visit in April of 1982, then May 14th. An area which had unexplained phenomena was a small storage room which had once been a porch. Something that was reported by several employees was the inability to breathe. Another unexplained occurrence was the glass sneeze guard over the salad bar, which would swing vigorously when it shouldn't, and glasses rattled and would smash themselves on the floor. For some reason, by this time, the presence in the restaurant, instead of being Ethel, had been named Sarah. After a visit in June, Jean Stevens withdrew from the investigation, claiming that things had gone badly. During her visit, she claimed something was pressing down on her and she couldn't sit up in her chair. She claimed that while having a session, all she heard was the words Ethel Allen repeated over and over in a high-pitched voice. She said it was the spirit of a young girl who complained that Ethel Allen was the only one who got any attention. She also dealt with the spirit of an older man wearing a white shirt, dark slacks, and brownish work boots. In 1985, Scott and Regina Falker bought the restaurant and changed the name to Ashley's, which is the name of the restaurant present day. They kept the old Tudor-style building, but the ghosts seem not to care what's the name of the restaurant or who owns it. An Ashley employee said she saw the feet of a woman wearing 1930s-era shoes in a stall next to her in the woman's bathroom. It turned out the stall was empty. The restaurant and the ghosts are still there today. Now, if you want to keep watching, you're going to see me do a video of when I walked around the Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings homestead, what's left of it, which is close to where I live at. And then later on, I did a twilight visit to Antioch Cemetery without really knowing where to find the grave. But if you want to stick around for that, just keep watching.